Welcome to The Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd. Today, it's our monthly book show and our topic, automobiles. Joining us is retired reference librarian Jill Erickson. Hello, Jill.
Good morning.
And New York Times bestselling author Peter Abrahams. Welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you both. You know, when I hear the promos for the monthly book show, I always try to think of a book that I've read on that topic, because I admit I'm a reader. I came up with nothing. And it was a little bit embarrassed. I could think of movies. I couldn't think of books. So I'm wondering, whose idea was it? Who came up with the automobile topic and why?
Well, I think it was me that came up with the automobiles, as I recall.
Because I'm a follower on this show.
And that's a really good question, because I think what I found, I was looking for various things. You know, I always look for something we haven't done before. I try to find something that we've never done before, which is hard when you've been doing this for 15, 18, how many years this has been going on. And so I thought, what would Peter like to do?
Thank you.
I was like, what can I find that Peter might be equally interested in? And so I started looking for books about automobiles, and I thought, there's not going to be that much. I don't know. But I came across this website that was some guy who had just listed like every novel that an automobile appeared in for decades, like from the beginning of automobiles. And I thought, wow, there's a lot here. I think we could make a show out of this. And as it turns out, I mean, we both have piles of books, and we could have 10 more piles of books, because there is so much, because there are so many aspects too that you could do. You can do, you know, books, novels that have automobiles somehow that are in there, but also there are all kinds of pieces related to cars and automobiles and how people use them and how they change and how they started. And so it's really a very excellent topic.
Yeah, I loved it. I love this topic.
Right. And I think it's one of those things, like anything, once you start looking, you find it, right?
And they are more, if you looked a little harder, you would have found more in fiction. I will tell you that. But it's not, but still, nonetheless, it's good, right, Peter?
Oh, for sure. And what you say about movies, that's very interesting. Movies love cars, because cars move and movies move. I mean, there are just so many shots that they can do with cars in movies, and so many stunts you can do.
Right.
Car, you know, even if cars become outdated and something replaces them, they'll always be in movies.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, let's start with you, Peter.
Okay, my first book is Driving with the Devil by Neil Thompson. The subtitle is Southern Moonshine, Detroit Wheels, and the Birth of NASCAR. So for people who don't know, NASCAR is the association of what used to be called stock car driving. There are two kinds of racing driving. There's the European open wheel Indy style car, you know, which were specially custom built to race. And then there were the stock cars, just normal cars that came off the assembly line and were souped up and those raced. And that stock car racing began in the South. And specifically, it began with the Moonshiners. So NASCAR now, which was formed in 1947, 1948, they've buried their origins. It appeared like, you know, Venus in the clamshell, you know, in 1948. That's absolutely not true. During Prohibition, the Moonshiners made, you know, whiskey, and then they had to ferry it down. So a lot of that happened in two places, all in Appalachia, but in northern Georgia and in western North Carolina. And so they would make the moonshine, and then they would have to run them to the mark, you know, for example, to Atlanta. So there's a town in North Georgia called Dawsonville, about 60 miles from Atlanta. Now it's almost like a suburb. But in those days, it was like, it's red clay country, dirt roads, and at nighttime, the moonshiners would take their cars and drive their moonshine down to Atlanta. And the Federales would try to catch them. And so you had these scenes on the road at night with some of these drivers were like 14 years old, and they were incredible drivers. And during that period, they began to race, and that was kind of the beginning of NASCAR. But if you a big thing that happened. So then when Prohibition ended, you might have thought, well, that's going to be the end of the moonshine. But it wasn't, because a lot of people still preferred the taste of moonshine, as you can tell in George Jones' famous song, White Lightning. White Lightning was the nickname for moonshine. And I think it sounds like this.
Back in the hills, little my old pappy, and he had him a steel. He brewed white lightning till the sun went down. Then he'd fill him a jug and he'd pass it around. Mighty, mighty pleasing, pappy's gone squeezing. Ooh, white lightning.
Okay, the great George Jones, and he drank plenty of it. I don't know what kind of a driver he was. I would never want to be on the road if George Jones was on the road. Anyway, these young drivers, Roy Hall, Lloyd Say, and of course Junior Johnson, who's probably the greatest stock car driver who ever lived, all began as moonshiners. And after that period finally ended, the stock car racing began in NASCAR. Developed a guy called Bill France, who had been a moonshiner, was the one organizing it, and he kind of took over the whole thing. His family still owns all of NASCAR. It's privately held, but it's this huge booming business. So in the movies, going back to movies, you've probably seen the scene, car chases. And there's a very famous move in car chases, which we've all seen. Here's how it started. When the moonshiners were on the road and they would be coming to a roadblock where the revenuers were. And here's how Lloyd Say did it. He invented this move. It plays out like this. Say hits the brake pedal and slows to 60, then 50. He releases the brake pedal and spins the wheel, then reaches down with one hand to tug on the emergency brake, which locks the rear wheels. The car twists violently, spinning precisely 180 degrees as it switches from 50 miles an hour forward to 50 miles an hour backward. With his car now pointed in the opposite direction, away from the roadblock, he releases the emergency brake and jams the accelerator. The car slows its backward slide, comes to a barely perceptible stop, unleashes a rocket plume of dirt and gravel behind it, finds a grip on the rocky red road, and shoots forward again, showering the cops with a fusillade of flying roadbed. In less than 10 seconds, Say is traveling 60 miles an hour, then 80, on his way back to 100 or more. Before the law has even shifted into gear, he's a mile ahead. In no time, he's out of reach and headed back to Dawsonville. You've seen that move in movies 1,000 times. This is the guy who invented it.
Yeah.
So I'm driving with the devil, all about NASCAR and these young men who invented stock car racing.
That was a great description. I was actually visualizing the whole thing as you read that passage. Wonderful. What have you got, Jill?
Well,
next?
I've got a much quieter sort of beginning with a quieter thing. And it was hard to choose, but I decided I would mention both, which is both the letters of E.B. White and also an essay that he wrote, because it turns out E.B. White really loved his car and loved cars in general. And this is one letter that he wrote from October 1940, where he's in Maine and he's writing to this friend of his, and they crossed the country in cars at one point. And he writes, "Dear Fred, I'm a fairly good-natured guy, but not about modern automobiles. The modern car is not only an atrocious piece of designing, it symbolizes the degeneracy that the magazine boys are yapping about. It is dishonest. All this nutty emphasis on streamlining is so much bilge, and it is deadly. My 1939 Plymouth, bought in the summer of 1938, had 3 dented fenders before the dawn of the year in which the car was supposed to have been made. These busted fenders were contributed by my wife, a careful woman, 5 feet 2 inches high. She dented the fenders because she had to guess where she is in relation to the tangible world, and her guesswork is not always 100% accurate." And he goes on to complain desperately about how the car was created. But he also wrote this very, very funny and lovely essay that was originally appeared in The New Yorker over the pseudonym Lee Strout White. I don't know why he was not at that point E.B. White. And it is called Farewell, My Lovely. And in parentheses at the top of this essay, he writes, an aging male kisses an old flame goodbye, circa 1936. And it is regarding his having to give up his car. And he writes, I see by the new Sears Roebuck catalog that it is still possible to buy an axle for a 1909 Model T Ford. But I am not deceived. The great days have faded. The end is in sight. Only one page in the current catalog is devoted to parts and accessories for the Model T. Yet everyone remembers springtimes when the Ford gadget section was larger than men's clothing, almost as large as household furnishings. The last Model T was built in 1927, and the car is fading from what scholars call the American scene. Which is an understatement, because to a few million people who grew up with it, the old Ford practically was the American scene. It was the miracle God had wrought. And it goes on and on, doing this beautiful tribute to his car that he loved so much. And it goes on for a very long time. I'm amazed at how much he could say about his cars. And I haven't ever read anything by him specifically about cars before doing this show. Although I'm sure somewhere in one of his kids' books, there must have been a car that he wrote beautifully about. But in any case, E.B. White is a huge fan of automobiles. And there are many, many letters talking about his cars. So I recommend E.B. White as well as this essay, which is just so lovely and so full of love for his car. Farewell, My Lovely.
Nice.
Well, I'm going to go out of order now. I had a whole orderly thing that was going to happen here. But because you mentioned the Model T, I'll go to the book I was going to do last, which is I Invented the Modern Age, The Rise of Henry Ford by Richard Snow. So this is basically this book. It isn't really, well, it's about the whole of Henry Ford's life, but it concentrates on the period from when he was a little boy to the development of the Model T and the success of the Model T. And then he covers the end of it, his life, in just a few pages. Anyway, Henry Ford, you know, he said this, it's a quote, I invented the modern age. When you read about, you know, there's something very bad about Henry Ford, of course, which we'll get to in a second. But, you know, he's not a one-of-a-kind figure, but he's one of a very small kind that there aren't many of. He's a mechanically inclined tinkerer. That's how he grew up as a little boy, with big dreams and a strong will. And that combination is I think what made him what he was. And this here's a little description of when he was a little boy. He grew up on a farm in Dearborn, Michigan, and he wasn't particularly interested in farming. He was interested in mechanical things from a very early age. The boy's mechanical ingenuity took forms more constructive than getting a yelp out of a school friend. When Henry was 7, one of William Ford's hired hands opened the back of his pocket watch and showed him how it worked. The jewel bearings, the tiny cogs, the busy mandibles of the escapement. Ford was fascinated and spent all the time he could during trips to Detroit peering into watchmakers' windows. And so very soon, once he saw what made them go, by the time he was 12, he could not only take watches apart, but put them back together so that they worked better than before. At school, he dissected them behind the screen of his open geometry book. His teacher must have seen something unusual in Henry Ford, for he fully acquiesced in these explorations, so long as his pupil didn't disturb the class with the rasping of a file. So he did, you know, he did a lot of things that changed society for sure. the European kind of car, the early cars that at turn of the century that were all very expensive. They were for like aristocrats. You had to be rich to buy them. His idea was to make a car that everybody could buy. And one of the ways he made that happen was he invented the idea of the assembly line, which you might think of as, you know, the kind of work where, you know, where in the European style, where like one person would do a whole lot of work on the car, not just, you know, putting in the doors or something like that. And now you're only doing one thing. But what that did was it brought the price, mass production brought the price way down, so that while these European style cars were selling for thousands of dollars, even then, equivalent of like $100,000, now the first Model T sold for $825 in 1908. So a lot of people could buy them. And by 1916, when he had the mass production really going, it was down to $350. The other thing that he did was he invented the 5-day work week, the 40-hour, all that. He wanted, he thought that it was fine for the workers to have leisure time. He was very anti-union, but he believed in that. So there were a lot of really good things that he did. The daily wage in 1914 that he paid was $5 a day. That was twice what the daily wage was anywhere else. The problem, of course, that people have noted with him is, you know, the anti-Semitism. He is mentioned favorably in Mein Kampf. You know, that's not something, the only American mentioned in it favorably. And that's not something you want on your resume. And he, you know, he started this paper called The Dearborn Independent. And odd that it's Dearborn again. He had a column. There were 91 issues before they finally closed it. And he had a column that later he said he didn't write himself and didn't even know the contents of, but it was anti-Semitic every time. You know, the whole conspiracy theory thing. Supposedly, when he, after the war, toward the end of the war, where he saw pictures of the liberation of the death camps, he had a stroke. He had had a series on them, but he had one of his very worst ones then and was never the same. I don't know whether that story is true or not. Anyway, really, if you want to know about, this is a great book for people who are interested in business too, because how he built out of nothing, how he built the Ford Motor Company, at one point, more than half the cars on the road in this country were Model T. So I invented the modern age, the rise of Henry Ford.
And let's do one more before we head to the break. Jill.
Okay. I have one, and it's a novel. It's a novel that was originally published in 1907, and I was sort of amazed that there were already novels being written about cars in 1907. This one is called The Scarlet Car by Richard Harding Davis. I had never heard of Richard Harding Davis prior to seeing this book. But it turns out he was, I mean, have you ever heard of him?
Never.
Richard Harding Davis. So, of course, I go to online to see who this guy is. And he lived 1864 to 1916. He was an American journalist and writer of fiction and drama, known foremost as the first American war correspondent to cover the Spanish-American War, the Second Boer War. And his writing greatly assisted the political career of Theodore Roosevelt. He also played a major role in the evolution of the American magazine. His influence extended to the world of fashion, and he is credited with making the clean shaven look popular among men at the turn of the 20th century. Now, that's a lot of stuff for one guy that I'd never heard of.
And he's a novelist.
And he's a novelist. And this one, The Scarlet Car, this is just, I'll read a little bit of, right at the beginning. It's not a great novel, but it's sort of interesting that it even exists. The first chapter is The Jailbreakers. For a long time, it had been arranged they all should go to the Harvard and Yale game in Winthrop's car. It was perfectly well understood. Even Peabody, who pictured himself and Miss Forbes in the back of the car with her brother and Winthrop in front, condescended to approve. It was necessary to invite Peabody because it was his great good fortune to be engaged to Miss Forbes. Her brother Sam had been invited not only because he could act as chaperone for his sister, but because, since they were at St. Paul's, Winthrop and he, either as participants or spectators, had never missed going together to the Yale-Harvard game. And Beatrice Forms herself had been invited because she was herself. So it's really, it's not, I would say, a great novel, but it's just so fascinating that they car, and they have terrible car troubles, not surprisingly, given the year of 1906, and then republished apparently in 1907. And they made a film out of this at some point. And the book has illustrations. And if you'd like to take a look at it, if you've never heard of the Project Gutenberg, by all means, look at the Project Gutenberg, because they have a copy of this book on their website.
And what's the title once again?
It's called The Scarlet Car by Richard Harding Davis.
It is our monthly book show, and we're discussing books about automobiles. With us is New York Times bestselling author Peter Abrahams and retired reference librarian Jill Erickson. Share your book suggestions at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd, and it's our monthly book show. Our theme this month, automobiles. With us, retired reference librarian Jill Erickson and New York Times bestselling author Peter Abrahams. If you'd like to share your book suggestions, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before we jump to Peter, from the control room, Jenny has a suggestion for the show. She says, it's a horror novel about a possessed vintage car that unleashes a reign of terror. And I think, Jill, you knew this one quickly, right?
I have not read it, though. So okay. Somebody else told me this
book. Christine by Stephen King. I have not read any Stephen King. I'm maybe a little bit too nervous, but maybe that.
I was going to say, I've read one Stephen King and it was so terrifying. I thought, that's it.
I'm not going to do it again. All right, Peter, what have you got next?
Well, I've got The Wind in the Willows. But I want to ask Jill if kids still are reading The Wind in the Willows.
Well, I think the bigger question, are kids reading at all? But I do not know. I would imagine there are still grandparents out there trying to get their grandchildren to read Wind in the Willows.
I read Wind in the Willows aloud to he's now 14, but he was probably 7 or 8. So we read it was a read aloud.
And was it a successful experience?
Oh, yeah, he loved it.
Okay,
yeah.
I think it's great. So The Wind in the Willows came out in 1908, and I'm shifting gears again because of you. And so it's a terrific kids' book. It's very British. It's all these, all these animal characters who can talk. They're sort of all from either the upper middle class or the upper class, which is Toad. And Kenneth Graham was the writer, and he said, it's a book of youth, and so perhaps chiefly for youth and those who still keep the spirit of youth alive in them. And I think I've always thought it's a wonderful book. The copy I have here has great illustrations by Michael Haake. Okay, one of the major plots in the book. Okay, so Mr. Toad lives in Toad Hall, and he's an aristocratic toad, and he loves motor cars and motoring, and he's had many, many bad accidents, and his friend, like Badger and Mole, do everything they can to keep him out of cars. He's under strict orders not to have anything to do with cars. So here's a scene of Mr. Toad. So interesting, because this is also 1908 when this book was written. So it was early in the days of cars. Supposedly, this sort of scene was inspired by the doings of one of the Vanderbilts at the time. So this is Mr. Toad. He's in an inn having dinner. He was about halfway through his meal when an only too familiar sound approaching down the street made him start and fall a trembling all over. The poop poop drew nearer and nearer. The car could be heard to turn into the inn yard and come to a stop, and Toad had to hold on to the leg of the coffee table to conceal his overmastering emotion. Presently, the party entered the coffee room, hungry, talkative, and gay, voluble on their experiences of the morning and the merits of the chariot that had brought them along so well. Toad listened eagerly, all ears for a time. At last, he could stand it no longer. He slipped out of the room quietly, paid his bill at the bar, and as soon as he got outside, sauntered round quietly to the inn yard. "There cannot be any harm," he said to himself, "in my only just looking at it." The car stood in the middle of the yard, quite unattended, the stable helps and other hangers-on being all at their dinner. Toad walked slowly round it, inspecting, criticizing, nursing deeply. "I wonder," he said to himself presently, "I wonder if this sort of car starts easily." The next scene is in a courtroom. So, I mean, it's just the... I love the book, but the backing up Jill's point, the kind of attraction of cars right from the get-go, you know, because 1908, there were not many cars on the road. There were no paved roads. It was not easy to, you know, drive them. And yet there was something magical about them even then. The Wind in the Willows, Kenneth Graham.
All right, Jill.
Well, I'm going to move us ahead in time and go to when women started driving. And this book I have is actually called Taking the Wheel, Women and the Coming of the Motor Age by Virginia Scharf. And it talks about when women started driving and how it helped women to drive when they learned how to drive and were able to drive. And there is a little art. There was a great review of this book, and the book starts, "There is no more scathing indictment of the ferocious sexism rampant in this society than that Americans have had to wait until the 91st year of the 20th century for the first truly comprehensive social history of the female driver. Iconoclastically smashing pernicious cultural and gender stereotypes, Virginia Scharf, who teaches history at the University of New Mexico, argues in Taking the Wheel that the political and economic enfranchisement of the American woman is the direct result of her casting off the prim haberdashery of the docile passenger, strapping on her goggles and bonnet, climbing into the driver's seat, and putting the pedal to the metal." This is like one of the best book reviews I've ever read. And I'm like, really? I hope. This actually came from the Wall Street Journal. And so he goes on, Joe Queenan is the guy that wrote this, and he goes on to say, "Casting a spotlight on the heretofore ignored history of female automobility," which I think is a great phrase, female automobility, "Ms. Scharf drives a spike through the hearts of male chauvinists everywhere when she proclaims that, quote, the enduring figure of the woman driver continues to embody fears about what women might do with plenty of money, big powerful machines, and relatively unrestricted freedom of movement," end quote. "It is a fear that continues to plague men at every intersection in the Republic." And I think certain people could read this book right now. It would be very helpful. I won't mention any names. But I think that it's really fascinating. And I will say, I got this copy that I have in my hand from the Boston Athenaeum. However, there is one within the network of CLAM, not within CLAMS, but within the state, that if you wanted to read this, you could get one through your local library.
Did you mention the publication date? I'm wondering.
The publication date on this is 1991.
Oh, okay.
1991, which seems like should have happened prior to that.
But yeah.
Like women were driving cars for a long time. But it also has great images in here. There's this one photo of a woman modeling, I gather, for the car. "Even as women have taken the wheel in an effort to widen the range of their activities, they are often still considered automotive accessories rather than independent pilots. This 1948 photo emphasizes women's role as hood ornament because they have this woman in sexy clothes standing on top of the car." So this is what was happening with women and cars. But one of the things I also found out in trying to put things together for this show is that, quite surprisingly to me, Virginia Woolf drove a car, and she bought a car, and she, in her diary, she talks about how incredibly excited she is that she has gotten her first car. And she writes here, A great storm has torn off one wing of my double windows, but I have never mentioned the absorbing subject, the subject which has filled our thoughts to the exclusion of Clive and Mary and literature and death and life, motor cars.
Wow.
I mean, like, who would expect this? Not me, and I've read a lot of Virginia Woolf. Anyway, every evening we go round with Pinker for a game in Gordon Square. I talk as if the evenings have been fine. No, we sit there in between the sulfur-colored storms under the shelter of trees with the rain pattering between the leaves. We talk of nothing but cars. And so, and she in fact does get a car. And she writes, this is on July 23rd, 1927. She writes, this is very near the end of the London season. I go to Ethel at Dieppe on Wednesday, then back to New Haven, where I may be met by my own car. Since making the last entry, I have learned enough to drive a car in the country alone. Now, I would never have guessed Virginia Woolf was driving around alone in a car, but she was. On the backs of paper, I write down instructions for starting cars. This is, again, 1927. We have a nice light little shut-up car in which we can travel thousands of miles. It is very dark blue with the paler line round it. The world gave me this for writing The Lighthouse, I reflect, a book which has now sold 3,160, perhaps, copies. Will sell 3,500 before it dies and thus far exceeds any other of mine. So thanks to The Lighthouse, she bought a car. Wow. I was just so...
Yeah.
I saw in all that she was driving around in a car. So it made me very happy to know that she was doing this and that it's all in the Diary of Virginia Woolf, which I've had on my shelf for a long time. And this happens to be volume 3, which is when she got her first car. So pick up, you never know.
That's just such a terrific point. And I sort of came upon it in my own reading for this because it turns out that the car developed not from the horseless carriage idea, but much more from the bicycle. And the bicycle was the first liberating thing for women. And so you've all seen pictures like of suffragettes on bikes. There's a reason for that. The area you could go in and buy yourself was, so it changed, and the car multiplied that. But the whole sort of area you could have for dating, suddenly you'd meet people not just from your little town, but the next town or the next. And the fact that women could drive themselves, and because cars and freedom, right? It's just, they're totally associated. And so it's very interesting to see, you know, there are some countries where women still can't drive. That's a real tell, in my opinion.
It is our monthly book show. We're discussing books about automobiles. Share your book suggestions at 866-999-4626 or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd, and it's our monthly book show. Our theme this month, automobiles. With us, retired reference librarian Jill Erickson and New York Times bestselling author Peter Abrahams. If you'd like to share your book suggestions, give us a call, 866-999-4626, or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Peter, you're up next.
Well, my question is there still such a thing as a coffee table? Is that an article of furniture that no one talks about coffee tables anymore? But I brought a coffee table book.
Oh, I was wondering where you were going with this.
Maybe there's no place to put it, right? Because, okay, so I thought, well, you know, okay, some cars are beautiful. You know, I mean, a lot of work and thinking has gone into design and manufacture of cars. And the look of them is really important. So I brought a book called A Man and His Car by Matt Ranick. And what it is it's certain, some men, it's all men, are invited to talk about a car of theirs. And then it's, then there are beautiful photographs like this one that I'm showing you.
That is beautiful.
Jay Leno's Buick Roadmaster 1955. Now, Jay Leno, you know, is a famous car collector. He has hundreds of cars. But when he left Boston in 1972 and went to L.A. to try to make it as a comedian, he first had bought this, he had bought this, he'll say it was 1972, and he bought a 1955 Buick Roadmaster for $350 and drove it out there, and he slept in it in L.A. He said, that's just, I didn't have a place to live, but it's L.A. You always get a car before you get a place to live. I slept in the car for a while, usually in the drugstore parking lot after sunset. It was fine. I had it all. And so this book is full of terrific, just, you know, beautiful pictures of cars with a short description. My actual favorite of the whole is the author's son, Nixon Rannick, at the age of 7, has this custom-built Land Rover. Now, it doesn't say he built it himself. It's custom-built. But so it's a little Land Rover. It's just a thing of a beauty, as you can see here, but at home you can't. And then the boy wrote the following description. What I like most about my truck is that it can drive and it has keys. I can open the back and climb in there. If I could change the truck, I'd want to have music and maybe be green and have doors that open. If the truck had music, I would play Bounce It by Juicy J. I like cars because they have cool wheels. My car has a tire on the front, and if my tire breaks, I can put another one on. I like to drive on the grass because it's a truck. Sometimes driving the car, I feel scared. I like driving with my sister Harlow because she's safer. When I get older, I want a Lamborghini, the red one, like in Dumb and Dumber. Boys and cars. I think that says it all. So this is A Man in His Car, a coffee table book by Matt Rannick.
All right, Jill.
I don't know how I can follow that. That's very good. But what I have here in front of me now is a book called The 99% Invisible City, A Field Guide to the Hidden World of Everyday Design by Roman Mars and Kurt Kohlstedt. Roman Mars, for those of you who do not know, has had a podcast on for a very long time, which I love. And although I have to say, when I was looking for books, I was like, oh, I'd forgotten that book, 99% Invisible. I need to be listening to that podcast again. He's really good. He just talks about all kinds of things. He's the creator and host of 99% Invisible, and as it says in his bio, the wildly popular podcast exploring architecture and design, for which he produced the most successful crowdfunding campaigns for a podcast in Kickstarter history. I was one of those people that helped him with his Kickstarter back when I was helping bunches of people with Kickstarter. Fast Company named Mars one of the 100 most creative people in 2013, and he was a TED main stage speaker in 2015. But what's most important about this book is that it has a whole section on roadways. And he writes at the beginning, the Romans figured out something critical when it came to maintaining an empire. If you want a bunch of disparate communities to function under one government, build roads. Roads are a staggering yet often overlooked technology. As the things that drive on them have gotten faster, traffic engineers have had to race to keep up, sometimes creating obstacles to slow us back down. Given how deceptively simple and ubiquitous roads are, it can be easy to miss how much their design and functions have shifted and adapted after time. And he has this whole section in this section of the book about rotaries. And those of you have spent any time in rotaries, which would be pretty much everybody living or visiting the Cape, might enjoy this. It's called Circulating Logic, this chapter, Rotating Junctions. He writes, the city of Carmel, Indiana, boasts an unusual claim to fame on its local government website. Quote, Carmel now has more than 125 roundabouts, which, of course, some places call it roundabouts. We call it something else, but you get the idea. Roundabouts more than any other city in the United States. According to city data, replacing signaled intersections with roundabouts has saved the city money while also reducing collisions by 40%, which seems like a big amount, and crashes with injuries by 80%. Drivers also save money on gas. While some find roundabouts confusing at first, which any of us who've gone through in the summer know many people think it's confusing, data suggests they are generally safer and more efficient at moving traffic than four-way stops and other kinds of intersections. While they have detractors, roundabouts, as it turns out, have big fans too. Across the Atlantic, where roundabouts are a bit more common, the irreverent UK Roundabout Appreciation Society extols the many virtues of, quote, the roundabout, truly an oasis of a sea on a sea of tarmac, end quote, which they view as far superior to, quote, fascist robotic traffic lights where we are told when to stop and go, end quote. And any discussion of British roundabouts must include the most magical of them all, the magic roundabout, which is what the rest of this article talks about. London in Swindon, England, this uncanny ring junction was designed by engineer Frank Blackmore of the British Transport and Road Research Laboratory back in the 1970s. And he goes on to discuss how it is and how it's working. And there's a little illustration of how it was first designed. So I think that this whole section he has here having to do with automobiles is really fascinating. But the whole book is really fascinating. It's the 99% Invisible City, a field guide to the hidden world of everyday design by Roman Mars. And if you've never listened to one of his podcasts, you should give it a go.
That up. All right. Thank you.
Well, I should just apropos of that.
Yes.
If you do go to England, of course, you're driving on the other side of the road. And that isn't a big problem. But when you get to one of the rotaries,
you have to go backwards.
That
in the
is counterclockwise. I've had several very confusing times. And of course, the British are very polite and don't honk very much. They honked at me.
Well, and the other, I have to say, when Matt and I once went into, we were in Scotland, I think it was, and we were, and he said, now, and we had rented a car, and he's like, just keep saying to me, go left, go left, go left, go left, as we go into the rotaries, because you are so
That's
trained.
That's where you can get, confused.
Yeah.
Well, can I, bring up children's book again. This is Richard Scarry's Cars and Trucks and Things That Go. I don't know. Okay, I don't want to say boys especially, not all, but many seem extremely interested from a very young age in cars and trucks. For example, a 3.5-year-old grandson known to me, when he goes anywhere, he's accompanied by a big bag full of toy cars and trucks that he then dumps on the floor wherever he is. When he goes to visit friends, he borrows, in quotes, cars and trucks of theirs. So this book, which is just a delight, every form of vehicle that you can possibly imagine is in it, and it's the sort of thread, the narrative thread that holds it together is this pig family, Ma, Pa, Pickles and Penny, set out on a picnic. And during the course of this picnic, they come upon hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of cars, from a glass window truck to an alligator car, three-wheeled beet truck, tank truck, all possible trucks and cars you can think of. Anyway, it's a frenzy of automated motion, and I think it's a wonderful book to read to a kid. Cars and Trucks and Things That Go.
Right, and the illustrations of Richard Scarry for all of his books are just... There's so many details and so much to see on each individual illustration, and both pages are filled with them.
Yes,
so
that's exactly right. There's more and more to find on them. Yeah. I think kids just love his books. He's terrific.
And my question about that book is, what year was it published? I mean, are the cars like, are there new looking cars?
No, none of them look like looking cars. 1974.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So
there's even an Apple car. I mean, so it's fanciful as well, right? I mean, it's not.
Yes, it's.
Oh, so it's got a whole.
Plane. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, some are realistic.
Some are real and
some
are not.
Yeah.
Okay.
But he's such a terrific artist that, you know, it's the kind of book a parent can read to a kid and you're not bored at all.
No, I agree.
Well, and I had to bring along a couple of kids' books. This one is, I just love the illustrations on this are quite lovely. I think I'm letting...
It's a dog waving to us from a
who's
from
in
an
a
open
sort of
window.
A polka dot car. It's called A New Car for Pickle by Sylvie Kantorowicz. And it begins with his little bird friend who says, tweet, tweet. Which, you know, what else would a little bird say? He says, time to get up, Pickle. Yawn, perfect day for a drive. Let's go to Clover Farm. We'll get some strawberries and some fresh cream. And the whole outing is about going to get this. But the car, of course, has many problems along the way. And so it's not an easy ride to get those strawberries, but they do eventually successfully get there. It's Pickle, a dog, and a bird friend. They decide to drive to Clover Farm to get some strawberries and, oh, I forgot, the fresh cream. But soon after they set out, the car breaks down. Instead of listening to the bird's advice, which was check the engine, Pickle exclaims, this car is junk, and starts a quest to purchase a new car. But as it happens, by the end of the book, and this is a short picture book, but by the end of the book, he gets his car that he loved fixed, and he is happy to move on again. A New Car for Pickle by Sylvie Kantorowicz, and really fun illustrations in here of the dog, for example, I think that's a dog, is green. And there are polka dots everywhere in this book as well, including on the car. So A New Car for Pickle.
I thought I would do something on road trips.
Oh,
But I maybe made the wrong choice, although I love the book. It's called Great Plains by Ian Fraser, who's a New Yorker writer, and I like his stuff a lot. And what he did was he spent several summers driving 25,000 miles in the Great Plains, and he met all kinds of people. He explored the past, the whole history of the Great Plains, just sort of, and what happened with the Indians there, and it comes alive. And the star of the book actually is Crazy Horse, in a way, and the best supporting actor is General Custer in the book. But there's very little on the car itself. See, I expected there'd be a lot about the car he was doing this in. It's a van, and he never says anything about the van. You don't even know what kind of, the model of the van. Let's see what he says here about it. He can afford to stay in motels very rarely. So I slept beneath the mercury lights of highway rest areas where my lone car was visible for 6 miles in any direction, and the inside of the men's room looked as if it had been sandblasted with tiny insects. And on the streets of small towns where the lawn sprinklers ran all night, and next to dammed up waters of the Missouri River where the white-topped branches of drowned trees rose above the waves. My van had so many pinholes from rust that it created a planetarium effect on the ground when I turned on the interior light. After a day of driving, there's usually a lot of dust on the bed and maybe a stunned grasshopper that had come through the open window. So it's that style of writing, beautifully detailed, every, pictures that you could see. But the van itself, that's the most you know of it. It's like this planetarium on wheels. So I recommend the book highly. Terrific on the history of the Great Plains and what you could find out in a road trip.
Excellent. I think, Jill, we have time for maybe one more from you.
One more. Okay. Well, I have to mention F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, and that about the movie. I was looking for stuff about the car, and the car in the book is very important, but the movie, it's like every movie review was talking about the car that was in that movie, and it was made a big hit. And there's more about cars in here that I could even imagine. And it starts with somebody having a very bad crash. And there's a very bad crash again. But he says, But as I walked down the steps, I saw that the evening was not quite over. 50 feet from the door, a dozen headlights illuminated a bizarre and tumultuous scene. In the ditch beside the road, right side up but violently shorn of one wheel, rested a new coupe which had left Gatsby's Drive not 2 minutes before. The sharp jut of a wall accounted for the detachment of the wheel, and it goes on to talk about what has happened and certainly suggests that there's going to be more trouble with cars in this novel. And a lot of just description of cars are in here. Here's one. At 9 o'clock one morning late in July, Gatsby's gorgeous car lurched up the rocky drive to my door and gave out a burst of melody from its three-noted horn. So if you want to read more about the cars in The Great Gatsby, look at the film or read the book.
And we will post a link with all the books mentioned this hour at our website, capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson and Peter Abrahams, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Amy Vinson from Indie Todd. Thanks for listening.